Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. This is your nav, John Lash, talking, recording on the morning, the pre-dawn hours of October 2nd, 2012. This is not a nav briefing. This is an audio commentary to accompany Crew Notes 21. And the title of those notes is Testing Channel 16. So that is also the title of this recording. It's just coming up on 6 in the morning here in Andalusia. I began writing these crew notes a little after midnight. At that time, the upper part of the celestial anchor was already rising over the eastern horizon. Jupiter was clearly visible, the Pleiades marking the stem or upper part of the anchor / antenna were visible, even though there's considerable ambient light from the moon, which is nearby in the constellation of the fishes. So I've been writing for most of the evening, and now I'm recording the audio commentary to go along with these notes, so it looks like once and for all I might have caught up with myself, and perhaps I'm even a little ahead of the game. One of the subjects in these Crew Notes 21, following the special edition of Crew Notes 20 that announced Ambergain House, is the topic of Channel 16. There is an occultation of Jupiter coming up on Friday, October 5th, about 3 days from now. So it looks like I'll be getting these notes and commentary out in time to set you up properly for that moment. And I have a lot to say about what Jupiter is doing right now and how we may finally be able to test Channel 16. In case you're all wondering how I'm doing, I'm fine. I'm in excellent health. I'm not having a Heineken for my breakfast this morning, just having some fruit juice. So if you hear the friendly tinkle of ice, you'll know that's what it is. Something wonderful has happened here in Andalusia over the last few days. At the very end of September, I think it was probably Thursday or Friday, we got some torrential rain. There were floods and deaths in some parts of the region around Malaga. Fortunately, I'm completely safe here, and everyone in the area is tremendously grateful for this massive rain, which may be marking the beginning of the winter season. Last year, there was pitiful lack of rain in Andalusia. Usually winter is the rainy season, and when it rains a lot and the aquifers fill, we can expect a glorious spring with abundant wildflowers and luxuriant display of nature's beauty in the fields. However, this year we have been suffering from near drought conditions until a few days ago. So it's not raining now. Today, the 1st of October, was a perfectly clear autumn day with billowing cumulus clouds and a turquoise sky. But the earth is saturated with water and obviously content to be drinking up this bounty from the heavens. I've been largely occupied with practical matters lately. It seems like I have an endless sequence of practical things to do regarding cars, houses, terraces, and other matters, which I enjoy when I can bring my attention to them. So I've been winterizing the second lower terrace. I have two lower terraces. Last year I converted the interior lower terrace to a chart room. Right now I'm winterizing the exterior lower terrace. And just in the last, over the last few months, because I didn't have enough room for layout of the Gaia navigation experiment, I converted what used to be a guest bedroom. I called it a guest bedroom, for lack of a better term, on the upper story of my house. I converted it into another writing room and office where I have layout space, and I can still barely keep track of the parameters and details of this experiment, even though I have devoted 1, 2, 3 rooms of my house to layout space. I must say that charting the course of the Gaian navigation experiment, that is to say, Sophia's correction, has become quite an immense task, although I don't like to use the word task or even the word work, because it is really a pleasure and it is also an exercise of great privilege. I must say, though, that given the way things are going, I find myself taxed to the very limit of my powers of description. And I am intent on being as clear and cogent as I can be as I continue to chart the course of correction. But it isn't easy, I can tell you that, especially with the introduction of the incorporation of the lunar nodes into the whole pattern, the whole configuration of celestial signals. And I'll have more to say about that as this commentary proceeds. So right now, it's a little before dawn. Jupiter is almost ready to cross the meridian where I am. And I expect Venus to be popping up over the eastern horizon any minute now. It's easy to observe the celestial anchor at night, and it becomes visible earlier and earlier in the evening now, so that you don't have to be a night owl who gets up just before dawn in order to see it. Every time I see it, I feel a shock of wonder. I feel, as perhaps you do, almost thrown back by the physical impact of the majesty and immensity of this new constellation. This is a new constellation. Now, it's true that the constellation will not always appear as it does now, because in its inception, Jupiter plays a unique role in defining the form of this constellation, the celestial anchor, the symbol of pleromic relay. Not only the symbol, but the instrument as well. So Jupiter will not always be there, although it will return every 12 years to relatively the same position where it is now. But during the fall of 2012, and again during the spring of 2013, Jupiter occupies that unique position between Aldebaran to the right and Elnath to the left that allows it to pinpoint the center of the crossbar in the upper part of the anchor. And that slanted crossbar, as I explained, is what signaled me to the formation before I actually saw what the formation was. Well, now the formation is stable, the formation is complete, and it is truly a glorious sight to see in the morning sky and earlier in the late evening sky. I include with these crew notes, a photograph sent in by crew member Vivi. Someone on the crew has actually the initials of Vivi. And it's a photograph that shows that moment when I observed that Venus, as it was passing through the twins, lined up with Sirius and Procyon. So you can see them there. Venus at the left, then to the right is Procyon, and to the right again, Sirius. And in fact, you can see Castor and Pollux as well, so you can see one side of the armature of the lower part of the celestial anchor. The companion star to Sirius, which is Mirzam, is not caught in this photograph, but it represents a mirror image to Castor and Pollux. And there, of course, you see that Procyon is indeed located symmetrically in that configuration. And it was actually the passage of Venus that drew me to that observation. So this photograph captures a significant moment in the nav's observation of the skies that has led to a most wonderful event. Just imagine you are accomplice in the formulation of a new constellation. And we may perhaps have some sense or understanding of how the Telestai felt when they introduced the new constellation of the scales around 400 BCE. I'm also including with these crew notes a screenshot from Stellarium for this morning, the dawn sky looking toward the east. And there you can see the moon standing at the border between the fishes and the ram. You can see the satanic head of Cetus. And you may recall the months back when we observed very closely the passage of the lunar apogee before the satanic head of Cetus, as well as the passage of Jupiter itself before that region of the sky. This screenshot shows the entire form of the celestial anchor. You can scan downward from the Pleiades to Jupiter at the center of the tilting crossbar, and then the long way down to Procyon. This is a big anchor, folks. The long way down to Procyon, and to the left, Castor and Pollux marking one end of the armature, Sirius and Mirzam on the right marking the other end of the lower armature of the celestial anchor, which may also be conceived as the relay antenna. The relay antenna has three parts. At the top, it has the actual relay device, the Pleiades. You might consider that to be something like the metal loop at the top of an anchor. Through the metal loop, the anchor line passes, and of course the anchor line secures the boat, secures the anchor to the boat, just as the 21 lines of the pleromic relay device secure the Earth to the galactic center. The second part of the anchor is the crossbeam, which involves two stars and a planet. Thus, we know that Jupiter plays an extremely important role in the formation of the celestial anchor. And we also know, you may recall, that the correction of the Aeon Sophia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter. So from the beginning of this experiment, Jupiter has been the planet that has required our greatest care and attention, and continues to do so even more now that it is placed in the bull, and there is a series of critical events in the bull proceeding from now into 2013. I include this screenshot so that you can picture where the moon is currently moving. You can see how it moves relative to the ecliptic, which is the line of the orbital plane of the Earth. Now, the Earth, of course, is always exactly on the ecliptic, and so is the Sun, because they are the bodies that define the ecliptic. The ecliptic, by the way, is not a circle either. It is a screw line. It is an oval or ellipse that is drawn out into an open spiral. But for the purpose of simplicity, we picture it as a circle. All of the planets move in relative proximity to the ecliptic, some shift above and some below it. Pluto has the tendency, which is not a planet, by the way, has a tendency to move extremely high above the ecliptic. But we see here that Jupiter stands just slightly below the red line of the ecliptic and the moon just slightly above. Now, if you picture the moon transiting toward Jupiter, there is a point just before it aligns to the Pleiades when it crosses the ecliptic. That is the south node of the moon, the point where it crosses over from being above the ecliptic to being below the ecliptic. The other line that you see on the screenshot is the blue line that represents an imaginary line in space. This is the celestial equator, or the projection of the Earth's equator into the celestial regions. And the angle of the moon, the height of the moon relative to the celestial equator, is called its declination. So you can picture that the declination of the moon relative to the celestial equator will vary depending on where the moon is relative to its crossing point or node. So currently, the moon reaches its highest point, its highest declination, when it transits the bull. And this is where all the significant activity is accumulated right now. So I explain these things in the crew notes. I won't reiterate all of it here because it's not necessary. But I would say that if you want to use Stellarium to picture upcoming events, this is one instance when I would consider it to be an acceptable measure to resort to an archonic device. And if you press the plus key, once you have set up Stellarium, you can see the way that Jupiter makes its retrograde loop in the bull, at the head of the bull. And that loop starts right now, as Jupiter is in its station turning retrograde. So what we have coming up on Friday and Saturday of October 2012 is a number of events. Nikki is sitting right on my documents as usual. Nikki? Okay. We have the occultation of Jupiter on Friday. Then there is a lunar apogee moment on Saturday. The apogee is in 6 Gemini, and that is also the day that Jupiter is stationary. Actually, Jupiter, it's the exact day of the Jupiter station. So Jupiter is making its station at the same moment of the occultation and the same moment of the lunar surge. And this, I want to indicate, is the dramatic moment to begin test running channel 16. So although there have been a number of Jupiter occultations already, we're not behind the game, we're not behind the eight ball, and we haven't really missed anything. One of the purposes of Crew Notes 21 is to set out my notion of how we can proceed with the experiment that teaches us how to use channel 16. Bear in mind that we are obliged to learn how to use it. And I'm proposing that we take this lunar occultation and the remaining three in 2012 to do just that. Now, I've already noted that there are some sharp, striking differences between the first half of the GNE and the second. One of these differences is that we now incorporate the lunar nodes, both the north and south node, into the nautical reckoning. And I have hesitated to do this until now, simply because we had plenty of things to consider going into this experiment, and I didn't want to overload your circuits. We've learned how to observe the moments of the lunar apogee and perigee, and I know that some of you are comfortable with it and are becoming more comfortable as the days go by. I originally used the analogy of a steering device. Call it the helm or tiller in nautical terms. That is the construction of the lunar apsides and the barycenter of the Earth. That is, in fact, the steering mechanism of the mother ship. And it acts like a driving yoke, such as you find on a race car, except that the shaft connecting to the transmission is not at the center of the yoke. One arm is longer than the other, obviously. The aphelion extension is longer than the perihelion extension. I already developed this analogy at the beginning of this experiment last year. So keeping that picture in mind, how would we perhaps describe the lunar nodes? Well, imagine that you're standing at the tiller of a ship, say a sailboat, and just for the sake of this illustration, let's imagine that the tiller is a large aluminum or steel wheel, as you find on some of those America-style racing boats. The size of the wheel is large because it's easier to turn it if it's large. Then imagine that there is a second kind of armature attached to the tiller, and it is a larger armature, actually, that has two attachments at each end, which are the nodes of the moon, and they are always opposite each other, whereas with the apogee and perigee, you know that they are not, or rarely, exactly in opposition to each other. But this additional structure that is attached to the steerage mechanism is a large symmetrical armature. And imagine that it is attached in such a way that it does not control, as such, the maneuvers of the ship. It does not control the motion of the ship. It does not control the motion of the ship moment by moment, but it regulates that motion over a certain period of time. So the lunar node mechanism is like a timer. It has the function of a timer, but it is also, strangely enough, a mechanical astronomical feature of the mother ship. We'll see if I can be clear in presenting you with user-friendly concepts of the lunar nodes as we proceed here. You know, the lunar nodes are really something when you get your mind into them, and I've had my mind into them for a while. They have been of deep and extensive interest to our species over many, many millennia of time. And it's remarkable that even though the lunar nodes cannot be observed, because they are not, of course, physically observable bodies, they have been closely observed and closely tracked from times well extending into prehistory. And the 18.6-year cycle of the lunar nodes is one of the perennial features that you find incorporated into megalithic sites and into the great astronomical clocks that are found around the world in such places as Stonehenge and, for instance, Callanish in the Hebrides of Scotland, Callanish on the Isle of Lewis. If you go to Callanish and stand there and look south along the alignment, as I did many years ago, you can picture how it was set up in relation to the lunar, what is called the lunar standstill, the extreme northern and southern lunar standstills, which occur every 18.6 years. So the ancients knew enough by their observation of the sky without the kind of astronomical instruments we have today. They knew enough to be able to construct megalithic sites that were perfectly aligned to the position of the moon at these unique 18.6-year moments. And Callanish is one example of that. Stonehenge also incorporates the 18.6-year cycle of the lunar nodes. So we're looking here at an element of sacred technology and sacred astronomy that has been widely and extensively developed in the past. Now we're going to bring it into a new function and into a novel and revolutionary application in the remaining half of this experiment. As I point out in the written notes, we can visualize where the lunar node is now located, which is on the back of the bull. It's just shifting away westward or to the right from alignment to the Pleiades. And so it's going to be passing soon from the bull into the ram. The lunar nodes, I'm talking here about the southern lunar node, the northern lunar node is opposite, and that's passing from the scorpion into the scales. But looking at the southern lunar node, we can visualize its transit in the coming months. And naturally, we tend to ask the question, well, where is it going to end up in March 24 at the formal completion of initialization of correction? Lo and behold, the lunar node in the March of 2014 stands around 30 degrees of the sign Aries, that is on the borderline between the fishes and the ram. And as you might recall, that point stands in direct alignment to M31, which is the Andromeda Galaxy. As I just said, tracking and interpreting the lunar nodes is a complex factor of navigation, which I am aiming to synthesize and lay out in clear and cogent terms, and it is doing so is perhaps the highest challenge that I have faced or will face in this experiment. I just want to say briefly, by way of introduction, that you can think of the lunar nodes as a kind of armature of cosmic memory. It's a kind of gear that is timed to 18.6 years, through which events on the time scale of the gods or the aeons can be integrated and incorporated into events on the human time scale. So it is like a step-down gear. It is a gearing device, what they call in mechanics a gear ratio. A pulley, for instance, has a certain gear ratio. In the rigging of a ship, we have pulleys. When we're out there on deck, pulling on the lines of the rigging of the mother ship, because she is, let's remember, a steam sailboat, we lift the very heavy rigging. It only takes a couple of hardy hands on deck to lift the crossbeam of a very heavy canvas. And why is that so? Because the rigging line goes through a pulley, and the pulley has a gear ratio which gives the advantage of adding force. The gear ratio involved with the lunar nodes is a step-down ratio. So it means that the force of events that are transpiring in the vast mill wheel of the galactic arms, which are measured on the time scale of precession, which is measured by an advance of 70 of 1 degree every 72 years, making a cycle of around 26,000 years. The events that occur in this vast time scale, corresponding to 1 day for the Aeon Sophia, can actually be translated by a gear ratio down into the frame of human timing. You know, 72 years, which it takes for 1 degree of precession, is a pretty good lifetime for a human being these days, you know. Who wouldn't be happy to live to 71 or to 72, you see? And that time frame breaks down into 4 cycles of complete rotations of the lunar nodes. So in that way, you can say that the massive cosmic timing of precession actually gears down into human life, and we can integrate and comprehend and enact that cosmic timing in the microcosm by following the rotations of the lunar nodes. So as I wrote here, the lunar nodes indicate 2 simultaneous and interwoven developments, which we are now going to observe and track very carefully in this experiment. First, they indicate how the wisdom goddess herself uses the insight drawn from her memories after she has recapitulated them. Now bear this in mind. The Aeon Sophia performs a recapitulation of her whole long lifespan since departing from the galactic center. And when involved in the process of recapitulation, as for her as for us as well, attention is deeply preoccupied with the recall of these events. However, once the events are recalled or recapitulated, you turn from retrieval to action. You act on the events that you have recapitulated. You act on the memories that you have reviewed. And so the lunar node shows how she does so and how she releases into the human psyche the very content of her own recapitulations. So this comes to the second part of the developments that can be tracked with the lunar nodes, namely, how her human animal accomplices come to be involved in cosmic remembrance or phylogenetic recall, which is a process involving transpersonal memories or race memories, as they used to be called. We are just at the beginning of this process. Actually, at the moment of initialization of Relay in June 2012, at the exact same moment, Jupiter converged into the south node of the moon, and that was about in 3 degrees of Gemini, 63 on the ecliptic, just off from the Pleiades. So you see the precision and the granular detail of these alignments. I have to emphasize to you that this immense event of the construction and implementation of Pleiromic Relay proceeds in granular detail, just as when a massive tower is constructed. If you could go back and imagine the mechanical feat of constructing and erecting the Eiffel Tower, we stand back now and we look at the Eiffel Tower, and it stands before us as quite an immense mechanical feat of engineering. It stands before us as a massive object. It might be compared to the massive presence of the celestial anchor in the sky. But in fact, Eiffel Tower was constructed, it required the installation of many, many nuts and bolts. And so the positioning of the beams, the soldering of the beams, the bolting together of the structure of the Eiffel Tower involved granular detail work. And we can actually have an understanding in granular and exact detail of how pleuromic relay is constructed and how it operates. And it's a great pleasure to have this. It's a great pleasure and a great art to be able to read the sky in this way and to make what we perceive into something that is actional. First, it is actional in your psyche. It is actional in your imagination. It charges your life. It seizes you. It compels you to live each moment in a higher order of reality. And as you live that way, eventually learn to translate and manifest the life of the cosmos in the events of your own life. You see, you'll hear many New Age people, of course, peddling the old cliche, as above, so below. And they might propose some metaphysical system for doing that. But you see, we do it in a different way. And in this experiment, it's done concretely. And it's done in a direct and vivid manner that requires no metaphysics whatsoever. So that about covers my intention for the first part of this audio commentary, corresponding to the first part of Crew Notes 21. Now we come to the fascinating question of testing Channel 16. I know that many of you have been breathlessly awaiting this moment, and so have I. Until now, I must say, I wasn't able to clearly sense how we might do this, you know. The thing that was bothering me about Channel 16 is that as we initially came to understand it was there, as we initially realized it was there and realized that it was composed of 5 pins out of the 21 pins of the pleuromic relay cable, wow, I mean, that in itself was an enormous piece of intel to take on board. And so I was able to indicate, I don't like to use the word suggest because it has connotations of mind control tactics, but I was able to indicate that my best guess, which was that it was a kind of intercom device, something we could use for conference calls, as it were, telepathic conference calls on channel 16, something like this. And a number of you picked up very rapidly on that. I'm sure that you've had experiences that indicate to you that channel 16 is operating already and that you, in one way or another, are operating with it. So I would say that over the past couple of months, you may have had fitful glimpses of channel 16. Compare it to tuning in to a ham radio station. I'm going to use the analogy of ham radio, by the way, off and on in the near future. Consider it like tuning into a ham radio station. You know, you fiddling with the dial and suddenly a signal comes on and you know you're receiving from a particular source, but then you lose the signal again. It wanders off frequency, then it wanders back on frequency again. So obviously, to be a successful ham operator, you have to know how to tune your machine so that you can pick up the specific frequencies on which you wish to communicate. That is to say, the other ham operators who are out there, you want to pick up the signals that you know, and you also want to be able to scan the frequencies in the event that you hear a new signal, a new voice, a new participant that you may want to dialogue with, you see. So this is a good analogy, I think. I'm going to use the old ham radio analogy. I like going back, you know. There are some aspects of Planetary Tantra, and even more so of Kala Tantra, which are very retro. And it's good to be retro, because actually archonic technology has taken us out of the realm of common sense, and many of the things that it's offered are counterintuitive, and we don't need them. Whereas the more simple mechanical inventions of the human animal have been useful and will continue to prove useful. So there's a certain retro bias, in my mind at least, and maybe in yours as well. And I like this ham operator, ham radio analogy, as you'll see coming up. It's a most exciting factor in that genre, an exciting factor in the use of channel 16. So scanning down the notes, you come to the heading Message of Intent. And there you'll see that I have specified that channel 16 is the coordinating modality of the console of the Shakti cluster. And it comprises an integrated circuit head of 5 pins of the 21-pin relay cable. The other 16 pins are distributed to the other modalities of the Shakti cluster, exclusive of channel 17, which is the grounding rod. So, the unique channel 16 plus 16 channels in pleuromic relay plus channel 17 for ground equals 18 points. And that is the summation of the Shakti cluster. So then I've included at that point in the text an image. This is a lithograph by Pablo Picasso, called Dance with Bandieras. I think it's pronounced Bandieras. A double L in Spanish pronounced like a Y, isn't it? And what are Bandieras? Well, if you look at a bullfight, those are the flowered or decorated, what can you call them? There's a word. I guess it would be spike. They are spikes. They are long, slender spikes with a metal tip. And they are used to impale the bull in the neck. Now, it's interesting that the Pleiades are sometimes pictured as placed on the neck of the bull. In a bullfight, before the final coup de grace is given to the bull with a long sword, bullfighter very elegantly dances with the bull, holding his hands up and coming close to the horns of the bull, and then driving the two bandoleras down into the neck of the bull. And the purpose of this is to weaken the neck muscles so that the bull can't hold its head up high. It drops its head. Therefore, it cannot use that powerful and devastating motion of thrusting its horns upward in order to attack the toreador. Also, the fact that the bull's head is held down gives the toreador access to that unique angle of penetration that he must make in order to pierce the bull in such a way that it cuts a certain artery in the neck and the bull dies relatively quickly. So it's what enables the placement of the bandieras is what enables the bullfighter to make a clean kill, if you will. Now, you may be offended by the whole subject of bullfighting, but that's neither here nor there. In this particular instance, it's a valuable and, if I may say so, pregnant metaphor. Also, if you don't care for the metaphor or the activity of bullfighting, it doesn't really matter, because the operative image here, this lithograph by Picasso, doesn't depict a bullfight, does it? It doesn't depict a fight at all, does it? It depicts a kind of dance, and I must say, a most elegant dance. In this dance, there are two components of the male and female gender of the human animal, and there is the head of a bull. This wonderful lithograph by Picasso captured my attention many years ago. This is not an easy piece of art to find for some reason. I originally found it in a book I had, which is now in my library collection coming to Amergain House, the Dover Art Library, Picasso Line Drawings and Prints. And I was so enamored of this lithograph, of which this is just a small detail off to the right of the original lithograph. There are some people standing in a doorway watching the man and woman in this ritual dance, this ritual act. I originally encountered this, and I was so enamored by it that I took it out of the book. And I think that it must be somewhere in my files, or I had it on the wall for a long time and I'd framed it and I used to look at it constantly. Then I wanted to get another copy, so I reordered that Dover Art Library book, but curiously, as far as I recall, that particular lithograph of all the line drawings that were in the book was no longer in that book. So can try to search for it on the internet. It's not easy to find. Anyway, I don't know exactly when Picasso did it, but I will say I think that the old master, macho creep that he was in some ways, really transcended himself in this work of art. And anyway, that's what art's for, isn't it? So hats off to you, Pablo. I'm not going to comment on what this image says. I would not presume to impose anything upon your imagination. I just ask you all to contemplate it, just to look at it, and let the beauty of it and the message of it seep into your mind and into your psyche. What we see is not a bullfight. The head of the bull has been severed from the animal. The man in a kneeling posture is holding it up, and the woman is planting the banderillas. What on earth is going on in this dance, in this ritual? The woman, the man, the banderillas, and the head of the bull. Bear in mind, as you're contemplating this image and letting it permeate your emotions and filter into your imagination, letting it catalyze whatever it may, that the activity of the planet Jupiter from this moment on until April 2013 is right there. Where you're looking, right there, in the forehead, between the horns of the bull, where the woman is elegantly implanting the banderillas. So how does this image relate to testing channel 16? And to inaugurating the series of four experiments that begin on Friday, October 5th. Well, a couple of days ago, I don't know when it was exactly, I was enjoying a glass of the good local Spanish wine. I think it was a Berberana, 2008. Now that was a year. And these Spanish wines are strong here because the mineral content of the land is strong, and the ground of Andalusia is hard. In certain ways, it's brutally hard. But in that brutality, there is also the protective force of this land. You know, every time I sip this Spanish wine, it makes sense to me that although the Aeon Sophia certainly released the signal of her terma all around the planet, this is where the signal caught. This is where the signal came to Earth. And in this hard earth of Andalusia, which produces these wonderfully sharp and delicious wines, lies the protective power that surrounds the terma of Gaia Awakening. And that same protective power surrounds Ambergain House. So I was sitting down there at the house with Jill. We were both sipping some Spanish wine and talking about Channel 16. And you know, as so often happens with me, how many more times have I have to tell you this? I can get a lot on my own. But some of the best things come when I'm hanging out with a woman, because it's in that pleasure of company, of companionship, the partnering of mind, body, and spirit that brings forth the treasures of the human animal. And so what I was not able to work out on my own in the chambers of my own mind came forth spontaneously as we were sitting around talking about Channel 16. And the image of Picasso's lithograph flashed into my mind once again at the same time that I realized in conversation with Jill the two other factors that would be utilized to set up the experiment, to set up the test of our group telepathy experiment. In the course of that conversation, and it happened quite quickly and with ease, it was a playful conversation, I realized that we can't just operate Channel 16 as if it's a kind of switchboard in which anyone can receive and transmit at any time. I don't think that it operates in that way. I realized that there would have to be a common factor, a common telepathic identity device used by everyone who gets on Channel 16. Now, what could that be? Well, I told you I've been thinking about the analogy of ham operators. And I thought, oh, I see. That's to be a call signal. And it's the same call signal for everyone who goes on the channel. Now, if you're a ham operator, you have your own call signal, which I seem to remember was three letters and three numbers. When I was living in LA way back when, I actually had a friend. She was a transsexual, close friend of mine for many years in LA. She was a ham operator and tried to get me interested in it, and I actually was fascinated by it. Maybe we're going to see a revival of ham radio now, and that might be useful in the future if some of the other telecommunication systems that the Archons have so generally foisted upon us collapse under the absurdity of their own Byzantine complexity. So anyway, a ham operator has his or her call signal, but all of us using Channel 16, use the same call sign, and that is GNE 5:16. Obvious. Just what could be more self-evident? You all know what GNE 5:16 means. And it's loaded, and charged with meaning. So when you call that signal, which is to say, you send it out telepathically, then you are putting yourself on channel 16 along with everyone else who uses the same signal. Okay, that's the first step. The two remaining steps to test channel 16 involve a wordless image and a language of syntax. So we use the channel simultaneously in a verbal and nonverbal manner. What is the nonverbal manner? For each designated experiment with channel 16, an image, icon, or symbol has to be selected. And that symbol is used for that one single and singular transmission that is timed, in this case, to the occultations of Jupiter. So, the occultation of Jupiter on Friday, October 5th, happens, I believe, around 9 o'clock in the evening, universal time. So around that time, you send out the call sign, GNE 516, and then it places before you the image of the Picasso lithograph. The image is an image. It's visual. It's nonverbal. There must always be a nonverbal component in transmissions using channel 16 and a verbal component combined. I believe this is one of the unique features of this channel, and we'll test it and find out if I'm correct or not. Okay? So to begin, we're going to use Picasso's Dance with Banderillas as the nonverbal component, the visual image. Finally, there comes the third factor in the test running of channel 16, and that is quite simply the language of the transmission, the verbal syntax. I'm calling this component of the test a message of intent. Why do I call it that? Well, when I was there talking with Jill about this subject the other day, something snapped in my mind, or perhaps in my brain, who knows? Things have been snapping in my brain quite a bit lately. Electrical snapping. Something snapped and I realized, wait. It's channel 16 is a 5-pin integrated circuit with very specific properties. And it cannot be used loosely. It cannot be used simply to send any telepathic message that anyone might come up with to another person, or even to send any telepathic message from one person to all the other members of the crew, for instance. No. I realized that there needs to be an intentional component in the message. The messages transmitted and received through channel 16 must carry an intent. Therefore, the intention must be inherent in the language of the transmission. In the wording of the transmission, there must always be an intent. And so I got the phrase, message of intent. Now, this gets to be really fun. This gets to be really exciting because the message of intent, the language of the transmission, obviously matches and goes along with the image. This is coordination of the verbal and nonverbal components of telepathic transmission. So you can have it both ways. You see? You can transmit through channel 16 simultaneously by image and by language. Now this is something fantastic. And I'm sure there is much, much more to learn in how to do this. But let's agree to follow these guidelines I'm proposing to you right now rigorously, just to see if they work. Now, if they don't work, other guidelines can be developed. But if they do work, it's important to observe the technicalities that are exactly suitable for using this channel. And I have a very strong hunch that this technicality of the simultaneous activation of verbal and nonverbal content is extremely important, along with the neat and nifty little factor of the call sign, which of course is a lot of fun. Can you imagine? Any number of people, several hundred people on this planet sitting around at the same time, the same time of day, on the 5th of October, using the same call sign, GNE516. How crazy wild is that? I mean, I just really love that idea. So now, finally, of course, we come to the formulation of the verbal component. The verbal component of transmission is not spoken outwardly, although you can rehearse it aloud if you want to. But at the moment of transmission, it's spoken or pronounced subvocally. Subvocally means that you imagine that you are saying the words without using your mouth, but that they are proceeding directly from your larynx, from the throat center. And what is the message of intent to accompany the image chosen for this first test? I propose this language. In this simulcast on channel 16, our message of intent is to match and blend the feminine and masculine aspects of divine imagination so that it reaches a crescendo expression of complicity in Sophia's dreaming for each and every one of us. End quote. What this syntax intends to say is that we have a common wish to match and blend the female and male, the feminine and masculine aspects of divine imagination. The force of divine imagination is bipolar. And just like a current that is composed of positive and negative aspects, an alternating current, the force of divine imagination, and it is, by the way, a physical force, as you shall soon learn, as this experiment may well prove, the force of it is bipolar, and so it has a masculine and feminine, or electric and magnetic properties, if you will. Don't speculate too much about what these are. Let's just leave them now loosely in the framework of feminine and masculine aspects of divine imagination. And our intention, which we are transmitting to each other and to the world at large, to the entire planet, through this channel, is to blend them, match them and blend them, so that they come to a crescendo of expression which brings each and every one of us into active, potent complicity in Sophia's dreaming. She needs our love to complete her dream. And that is not just our love for her, the planetary animal mother, but our love for each other as participants in this experiment. So there is, without using the word love, a powerful permeation, a deep permeation of your love in this intention. You would only make this intention and state this intention out of love. And so, how does the test work? How do we know, once we have accomplished the test by combining these three factors, the call sign, the nonverbal, and the verbal components, how do we look for the results of the test? What are the results of the test of using channel 16 in this way? Well, I propose to you, my friends and crew members and students and allies scattered here and there across time and space, that the results of doing this would become evident in the ensuing month, in the ensuing interval of time, until the next occultation of Jupiter. And that the results would be of many kinds, that we would be required by this experiment to be vigilant in observing the results as a follow-up to the moment of simulcast, okay? But primarily of the many forms, the many and diverse forms the results could take, I would say, let's look for these results in two areas. First of all, if you observe anything that's happening in the outer world, however you do it, either by intermingling with people in the world, watching the various media, following the alternative media, if you have some moderately trustworthy channels, whatever you do to observe what is happening in the collective life of humanity, see if you can observe any indications that this crescendo is breaking through. Even among those who know nothing about Sophia's dreaming, who don't understand the process of correction in the way that we do, even among those actors in the human drama who are oblivious to our privileged knowledge, let's consider that we could see things happening, things being said and done, which demonstrate that the masculine and feminine polarities of divine imagination have been blended, and that they are causing a crescendo expression of some kind, a crescendo expression in the reality shift of the current moment on this planet. So we'll look to the collective, and then we'll also look among ourselves. In order to do this, it would be imperative to set up a forum or some kind of chat room where members of the crew can sign in and share their experiences in the follow-up to the simulcast that occurs during the occultation. The results of our transmission to the world and among ourselves ensue in the following month. And during that month, we need to have a way to communicate with each other and to share our impressions and our discoveries and what we are detecting and observing both in ourselves and in the world at large. So I am calling for someone to set this up, and I explain in detail also in the text that it would be also extremely helpful if someone would act as the scribe or logger who would eventually pull together and synthesize the results of the 1 month experiment so that I can upload it on gaiaspora.org, and then we'll go on next time to a second experiment, perhaps repeating the same image and language, perhaps shifting to another image and language. So that's the idea, that's the delightful prospect and the delightful invitation that I make to you all of how to use Channel 16. I'd like to point out that this way to test run the channel leaves it open, but it doesn't leave it too open, because it just cannot be some kind of telepathic free-for-all where we're all transmitting signals back and forth. There has to be something in the method of using the channel that causes the totality of our telepathic energies to cohere. We want coherence in the experiment, we want coherence in the initial signal, and we want coherence in the results. And I am banking on the chance that this simple setup will provide for that coherence, which is so desirable and so necessary in using this channel correctly. So that's 1 hour and 11 minutes. I'll leave it at that. I'll sign off for now. You'll note that I am posting on Gaiaspora.org some notes about visitations to Ambergane House. And these notes will continue to develop as people come and as the situation defines itself over the next few months. I do require some assistance in the arrangements for bringing people to Ambergane House, and that is all explained in the notes, and it will be self-evident to any of you who read them. So it's still dark outside, but let me take a peek. Yes, indeed, Jupiter is high overhead. The sky is pitch black, and there is the glorious sight of Venus, standing very close to the star Regulus in the heart of the lion. So if any of you get a chance in the next couple of days coming up on these momentous events of this weekend to observe the sky at this time of the morning, you'll see that Venus is near a bright star, and that is Regulus in the lion's heart. So with a roar from the mother lion coming out of my soul, I greet you all and thank you for your courage and determination. This is your nav signing off for now and wishing you all safe passage.